The Market Musings Podcast.
Okay. Good. Right. Well, hello and welcome on to the Market Musings Podcast here from Stopwatch. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Jenny Shaggis, also known as Jenny Many Dots on Twitter, or X as it's now known. And that's how I did indeed come across you, Jenny. But thank you very much for your time. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, very good, thank you. Very, very good. So thank you very much for joining us. I mean, first of all, I've been following you for a while. You're obviously a mining stock investor. I mean, just give us a bit of your background, if you can, to start us off here. How you really got into mining stocks? Because it's a very niche sort of place to invest in. I know that's where I'm pretty heavy as well. That's where I started, was investing in mining stocks. And I'll be honest, I came across it totally by accident, and I thought it was quite exciting to be treasure hunting. But what brought you into the sector?
Sure. So I started my career as an energy trading analyst. I worked on a large trading floor for an oil and gas company here in Calgary, Alberta. And that's where I met my former husband. And we had three children, and he traveled quite a bit for work. So we decided it was probably best if I stayed home to raise the kids. But, you know, I really missed the excitement of the trading floor and the market, and hoped that one day I could return to that career. But Alberta, the province that I live in, it's Canada's energy producing province. And, you know, people that invest in commodities are certainly familiar with the cyclicality of this sector.
Yeah.
And you're living in a city where people's livelihoods are impacted by that, I've lived here for 30 years now, and I've seen family and friends that, you know, they go to work in the morning and they're handed a cardboard box and told to pack up their belongings, that they're not needed anymore. And these are engineers and the like, very serious, successful people. And it's heartbreaking to see people's lives impacted like that. And I think given the years I've been here and witnessed that, it's really made me a passionate advocate for the natural resources sector. And my ex actually, he did business development on a nuclear reactor. And he and I would often have really interesting discussions about uranium and nuclear energy. So that kind of combined with my background in oil and gas, I was already really interested in commodities. But it was when the pandemic hit. So obviously the pandemic was really hard for a lot of people. But in my case, if you Google the top 5 most stressful life events that can happen to somebody, I had 4 out of 5 happen to me during the pandemic. So it wasn't just the pandemic. It was just a really trying time in my life.
Sure.
But I'm a real big believer that some of your biggest blessings can come from your worst situations. And that was the case for me. And that's actually how I came across the mining industry. Is during that time, my mom passed away. And when I received my inheritance from her, I decided to start a small family fund. And I've done really well with it. And I think she would be quite thrilled if she knew how my life had gone because of that. So it was that, but also, you know, I wasn't really that active on social media until the pandemic. And Twitter just was a godsend for me. It was a great place to find ideas and to meet some really interesting people. And I stumbled across my community, shall we say, the MinTwit community, mining Twitter, and got some, you know, really great ideas, met some fantastic people who I have since met at conferences in real life. And it was just a real blessing that I came across that. And at the time, so this was 2019, 2020, I had been reading about the growth that was forecast for EV sales. And so I thought lithium had a lot of potential. And I loaded up on some quality lithium stocks in that time period. And I read a lot about battery chemistries that were evolving, and I knew that lithium is abundant, and so it was more a matter of bringing this supply online. And at that point, that the bull case would likely fade. And so I you know, I had, like I said, loaded up on these quality lithium plays. And I watched as the lithium price peaked in November 2022. Mm-hmm. And I exited my lithium stocks in February 2023. And I had returns that ranged from about 500% to about 4,000% on one. And so I did really well. And there's an account on Twitter I'm quite fond of, Ian Castle, who was the founder of the Microcap Club. Yeah. And he has said that your early experiences often shape your future risk tolerance. And I found that that was the case for me. It was like somebody had injected this alpha from junior exploration companies into my veins. And I was addicted from that point on. And now to this day, it's very hard for me to hold a large cap stock because, you know, these junior exploration companies are kind of beckoning to me with the returns that you can have there.
Sure.
And, you know, it's not something I would ever suggest to people that they go as heavily into them as I do, because I'm fortunate I have the time and I can focus solely on them. But I know Rick Rule has suggested to people that you don't buy more than you can maybe spend an hour a month researching. And I think that's really good advice, because I almost refer to them like they're toddlers. You really have to monitor on a constant basis, because things can change jurisdiction risk with a lot of these, and they really do take a lot of time and effort. So I'm fortunate that I can put the time in, but yeah, once you get that kind of a return, it's really hard to invest in other sectors. And so I've really been drawn to the mining industry ever since.
Sure. So would you say you I don't want to say playing, because I think that's a good word, but investing at the lower end of the market. So, I mean, are we talking companies sub 100 million, sub 10 million valuation?
Preferably sub 10 for me. I really like to get in quite early.
Early as you can. Yeah. Okay. It's an amazing little story, and fantastic that you've put your mother's inheritance there to very good use. Is this something you do effectively full time then now?
Yes, full time.
Yeah, okay, excellent. And obviously well done on the lithium. I mean, I know a lot of investors in the lithium space who perhaps didn't see that top coming in and have been holding stocks really from, huge peak all the way down. I mean, what signs said to you that the top is in lithium?
A couple of things. In social media, I find is a really valuable tool for okay. A sentiment gauge in that regard. I follow some of the chat boards, and then on Twitter, and you see when people start piling in that really haven't done the research, for one thing. And then there's a lot of neurology place that I found a lot of companies that I wouldn't necessarily have bought. I didn't think they were quality management teams, started to really pile in, and that for me was a pretty solid indicator, and that was a big part of it. But like I mentioned, I kept up with the supply case, and it's a little bit of a instinct too, that you know, when you watch the charts and things like that, when the price has peaked, and all of those factors combined can give you a pretty good idea.
So you're watching really the underlying commodity. When it came to lithium anyway, you were watching the underlying macro effectively of the commodity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So, I mean, how does it put us, let's say, I just want to bring on to gold, because gold at the minute is everyone's talk. And as you say, you know, when everyone's sort of talking about it and there's a lot of excitement about it, and perhaps people who don't normally invest or don't really know much about it are talking about it, a bit like when the whole kind of crypto and Bitcoin bull wave happened again during the COVID pandemic, when everyone was effectively buying it without any real research into it. I mean, would you say that at the minute, are you looking at gold, or is gold saying, oh, hang on a minute, it's a bit too, everyone's too excited about it, it might pull back a bit?
I think it will likely pull back a bit, but just there's so much political chaos right now.
Yeah.
For me, I do hold a few gold exploration companies, but I'm more partial to copper. Fundamentally, I think that has the case is a little more certain there. But gold, I probably rather hold physical gold myself.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think there's still a lot of room for the miners to move. So it never really seemed to have trickled down to, you know, the smaller
the juniors.
Yeah.
Not yet. No, the vibe I was getting from the Swiss Mining Institute from, real savvy investors plus real savvy technical analysts as well, was that the gold bull case is here to stay. Moves up to 3,400 by the summer with what they referred to as cold showers, so $100 to $200 small pullbacks, but nothing to get worried about, really, just a buying opportunity. And one big commodities investor over here in the Netherlands, actually, he made a prediction that gold would be $5,000 in 18 months' time. So, you know, he is biased, of course. He runs a discovery commodity fund that is quite heavy in gold. But it's nice to see that the general consensus was that, yes, there is optimism, but that can linger for quite a while. Before we talk about copper and some other things, I just want to get an idea of if you had any sort of mentors in the space or people you look up to. You mentioned Ian Cassell, for example. Have you really found that mining Mintwit? Did you say Mintwit? Yeah, that kind of group really useful for you?
I have. Yeah, I think networking is just really important in the industry. It's so small. You know, if you look at the number of investors that would invest in a company like NVIDIA or Google versus the junior exploration sector, it really gives you an edge when you start to get to know people and attend these conferences. And for me, I adore Rick Rule. I've listened to umpteen Rick Rule interviews now. I've met him a number of times in person. And, you know, he's just such a good soul and has so many pearls of wisdom that he shares with people that I think there's a difference when you hear somebody versus when you actually listen to them. And if people actually listened to what Rick is saying and, you know, put that into practice, you can do phenomenally well. I've heard him say repeatedly about investing in the top names in the sector that had he just stuck with that himself, that he would have probably had to put in 1/10 the effort and had 10 times the return. And I think he's bang on with that. And that's been my experience as well. I love to follow the Lundin family. They just have a phenomenal track record. And following names like that, you can do quite well. I mean, the sector is definitely very high risk. But if you put into practice a lot of the things that Rick says, I think, like I said, you can do really well. So he's probably the one I would for sure mention as a mentor.
Yeah, Rick is fantastic. And as you say, a wealth of knowledge. I love this story that he effectively started a bar as a side gig and got talking to mining CEOs effectively. But you're right. I mean, it's all about the network, isn't it, particularly in this space? And it's great that you say that you were sort of chatting to people or got to know people online and then met them in person. That's exactly what happened to me. And you sort of see these usernames on chat boards and then you go to investor events and you realise, oh, you're that person, okay. You sort of build it out from there. And I think that is really important. You've got to get out and connect with these people. If you can just do it virtually on Twitter or on LinkedIn, for example, I think it really will help you to build your network out. And it's a bit of a cliche, but your net worth is your network. And I do very much believe in that. You mentioned, I think you said, 500 to 4,000% returns on some of those lithium stocks. So those are obviously pretty big wins. Have you had any epic flops, epic fails at the moment, or are you still sort of waiting on that?
I have, in terms of, it's really been, 2024 was a horrible year.
Definitely
like quality juniors that I've been holding for some time just performed really poorly, and it's been really disappointing. So some of the mistakes I've made there, I would say, is I do like to get in early, but in a case like this where 2024 was a terrible year, that definitely hurt me. So I think in the future I would suggest, and this is one thing I've learned, is to really watch for certain signs of when it's a good time to get in. And if you like a company, like the management team and their assets, to start out small and build your position with positive developments, because it can be a long wait for a lot of these juniors to actually have results that can move this dog. And so in the case of one of my highest conviction picks, I've been holding it for over 2 years now. And it's really just now that the share price is starting to move a little bit. But I think next time I would watch for when the CEO really starts marketing, because in this case, that was sort of a good indication. He wasn't ready to tell the story quite yet. And I bought the story. I loved it. But I don't think it was at the point where the market would love it as much as I did. And so that would be one sign that I would watch for, as well as perhaps insider buying, because I find that's a really solid indicator. Okay. When they start picking up shares in large amounts, you kind of know that, you know, positive developments will probably impact the share price in the next 6 months to a year. And so that's a good indicator. The other thing that I would tell people that I've learned is play seasonality. I think a lot of people feel kind of guilty as though they're a disloyal shareholder when they do that. And you know, I don't think that's the case at all. I still believe very much in the companies that I'm holding, but it's the prudent thing to do, because you know, these are very high risk stocks. And so if you take a little off the top at the end of the drill season and you buy the dip when there's a bit of a lull in the activity, you can really reduce your risk. And I just think it's a wise thing to do, and you shouldn't feel guilty about doing that.
So when you say seasonality, you're talking sort of the expiration season or the field season, as I know it's called in North America. What about the sort of, I don't know if it's the same over in North America, but certainly in Europe anyway, in the summer months, the markets tend to go pretty dead. So we're talking seasonality in terms of actual, yeah, the summer months go away and enjoy a holiday, effectively come back in September, October.
For sure. Yeah, there's a bit of that sell in May, go away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I do rely a lot on the drill season for these companies. One of the ones that I hold is Fireweed Metals. Okay. And it's in the Yukon, and they have a very small drill season. And, you know, the ideal time to buy that stock is kind of February, March timeframe. And sure enough, it happened again this year. And I was really glad I picked up some shares when it took that seasonal dip. And so I think that's really important, is to touch base with management and confirm the drill season, because even like altitude can affect that. I have a lot of investments in Latin America, and some of them are higher up that, you know, your drill season is dependent on that. And if you're familiar with that, I think it's really important. I've had people message me on Twitter because they think, you know, something has changed, something's wrong with the company because the share price has been dropping. And I check seasonality, because it just happens all the time. And it's not a reason to panic. It's a reason to buy the dip, for sure.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things you said there that indeed I've learned on my, I would say, 12-year mining investment journey, which is, yeah, if you've made some money, take some off the table. There's absolutely no one ever went to bust taking a profit, effectively. It's very difficult to do, because you can get emotionally attached to some of these stocks, particularly if you've been following them for a while. You can get very emotionally attached to them, which means that you hold on. Also greed, whether people want to admit it or not, you know, that kind of, I think, human nature, if you like, to kind of be greedy and want more all the time is what wipes people out in this thing, because you hold on for way longer than you should do, and then it sort of all comes back. And the other thing I think you said that was really important was you can start small and build up. Another thing I've learned is when you feel you've got to buy this stock now and put everything into it, it's never the case, unless you're extremely lucky. You've got time to build a position in that company over a period of months. Or even years, you know. So I think that those are really important points there. One thing you mentioned about this, the 2024, do you think it was just the year rather than particularly a bad choice on your part or a bad decision on management or lack of luck in the field? Do you think it was, I know it was a tough year, do you think that was the main issue, do you think, for yourself last year?
I do. I go over everything I'm holding fairly often, and there isn't anything in my portfolio right now that I really regret. I think it really just was a tough year for the sector. And I saw it with some of the ones that I held that actually had really great drill results. And it seemed as though the spike really was very temporary. It didn't have a lasting effect. And it was almost like a sell on positive news for a lot of them. And people are just so focused on the tech sector right now and these speculative assets like crypto, that we just haven't seen the sector rotation yet into mining stocks. And I always say, you know, the world needs metals more than the metaverse. And I do think, you know, at some point there's going to be a return to the sector. And like we had mentioned, the gold price is really attracting some eyes once again. And so I think once we see a little bit of a collapse with the Mag 7, I think that people will maybe return to the hard assets like this. So I do think it was more 2024 than it was my choices.
Yeah, okay. I would tend to agree. And I mean, for us, we're more London focused. 2023, you start to see it getting a little bit tough, and 2024 was particularly bad. I kind of make the joke that in 2023, people had scratches. 2024, they'd become cuts, and maybe 2025, people will start losing limbs if it continues. I hope it doesn't. But I mean, certainly on the junior end of the London stocks, the values are so low. It's either the point where, well, it all goes away and London ceases to exist as a mining investment space, or it comes back. And you have to follow the money as well. And as I say, some of the big funds are now starting to position because they are simply just too cheap not to buy. And me personally, I didn't put fresh money in the markets for a couple of years, but I started the back end of last year because I just saw, you know, these companies, they're practically £1 million, £1.5 million, £2 million market cap. It's hardly anything, you know. So they either it's like they either disappear completely, or indeed, you know, the sector does start to come back. Have you seen cycles before then, would you say, in your time in private equity? Or how are you understanding that mining cyclical nature of that sector?
Well, for me, as I mentioned in Calgary, I've certainly seen it in the energy sector. Mm-hmm. Mining, I haven't really lived through that in the past because I've been doing this focused exclusively on mining stocks now for about 6 years. And so it's more a matter of when I mentioned about networking and talking to people that have been around for decades. Yeah. It's, you know, you learn from their experiences. And yeah. Rick is one, Ross Beatty, that I've listened to speak fairly often to. They're just shocked. They've never seen it like this. And you know, you look at the statistics too, back in, there's a graphic that I often share with people about the returns in 2008 to 2011 when mining had a bull run. And when you see something like that and you know it's potentially coming, because it really does feel like a lot of these have bottomed and they can't get much cheaper. No. And so, I really believe in a lot of the ones that I'm holding, and I'm just waiting for that capital to return. And I think we just need the catalyst, and gold price could very well be it.
Yeah. I know an investor for a long, long time has had a couple of, or maybe three CEO roles now, and he talks about that period. And it was a great period. I was too young. I was at university at that point. But he said you would wake up every morning and it wasn't a question of had you lost money. It was how much more am I worth today? Because every single day it was just up and up and up. So your net worth was just increasing. What a great era to be in. I hope that comes back. So when it comes to what you look for when you pick stocks, I know you said you're quite keen on copper. So, I mean, what is it you look at? Are you looking at management teams? Are you keeping an eye on the technicals when it comes to drill results or the balance sheet of the company? Or are you going really after the commodity play as a primary sort of data set to pick your investments?
So it's a combination of all of those factors. But for me, when I'm looking at a company, or quite often I'll receive a message on Twitter and somebody asks me, Jenny, what do you think of this company?
Okay.
But the very first thing that I always do, if you have ever been to the website ceo.ca, I love that website. But yeah. One of the things I really love about it is the ease with which you can examine insider history. And you click on the one button and it brings up, you know, their transactions in the company you're looking at. But mm-hmm. if you select the insider name specifically, you can see mm-hmm. their history. And I always tell people you have to read those tea leaves because they can tell you so much about a person and their track record. And okay. I don't like to see when people have a history of being granted options and selling on the market. And some people just, that's the lifestyle companies, that they have this repeated pattern of doing that, or they'll refocus, they'll pivot to a different commodity, a different jurisdiction. And it's kind of like a rinse and repeat. And so those are the things I tend to avoid. I like to see insiders that are really focused on just one company, maximum two, and that are putting their own personal funds into the company instead of just, you know, accumulating free shares, basically. So that to me is a priority. I look at that. And then I look at salaries, if their salary is fairly competitive. But one thing I think that it's important people look into is, quite often in the fine print, it'll mention consulting fees. And, you know, I don't want to see management being paid a salary and then pocketing consulting fees on top of that. So I look at how much money is going into the ground for exploration versus G&A. I think that's a really important gauge too. But one thing I tell people, that if they're unsure about a company, I say do a 2-in-2 test. And the 2-in-2 test for me is, can you find two insiders on the team that have at least twice returned significant profits to shareholders? Because if you've seen that and you can verify that that was indeed the case, I think it really improves your odds of a good return with the stock. You really want to invest in proven people. And, you know, there's a lot of course, younger people that may not have that experience yet. But these other red flags that I look for with the options and salaries, I think that's a really good indicator. Sure. And if you're dealing with somebody that has less experience, have they worked with proven people in the past? Have they, you know, been involved with a Robert Friedland, for example? Because somebody like Robert Friedland, he's got top tier talent to choose from. And if he's chosen to work with somebody, then, you know, that speaks very well of them. And, and I just think management is really key. They have not proven the resource yet, but if you're investing in people that have a history of doing that, it really just increases your odds of success.
Indeed. And can you find that all out on ceo.ca, or are you digging much deeper than that into the company's announcements?
I do. I definitely dig deeper. But for me, that actually it takes 5 minutes to do that check. And I can rule out 90% of the companies just by doing that. So it's fairly effective, in my opinion. I might miss one or two that turn out, you know, to be very profitable. But overall, I just find it's a really effective and quick filter. And so, yeah, I do that first. And then after that, I start to look into the finer details, prior drill results and what work has been done on the property, things like that. But initially, for sure, it's all about the insiders.
Yeah, all about the management. No, it is. And people buy people, you know, it's really important that you've got good people running these companies. I mean, are you, would you say, jurisdiction agnostic? Do you mind where the quality or the project is in the world?
I am somewhat jurisdiction agnostic. I'm avoiding certain parts of Africa for sure right now. And there's ones that I would consider higher risk, but I'm heavily invested in Peru. And I think one of the benefits there of buying right now is they were hit really hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, actually the worst globally. And at the same time, just as the pandemic was ending, they had a lot of political chaos. And it really caused a lot of investor uncertainty. And the government there is, they've done a fabulous job with the mining sector, but they actually have a historical low approval rating right now. And there's an election there next year, and that could change things. But what I found in Peru is it actually has a lot more to do with local community risk than it does the government itself. Okay. And so I think when, you know, you're considering jurisdiction risk in certain countries, it's very important to consider the local risk versus just ruling out an entire country.
Yeah, indeed. Excellent. That's good advice. Okay, so when it comes to the commodities then that you're focusing on at the moment, you're pretty into copper. What else are you looking at? Gold as well? Are you chasing these stocks? Or do you also look for a commodity that's unloved? Or do you stay away from the ones that are down at the bottom?
I do. I will look at some of those. I really largely invest in gold and copper.
Okay.
But I tend to avoid the more obscure metals. So, for example, China implemented export restrictions on germanium and gallium. And, it's difficult to find solid exploration companies for the more obscure metals like that. But sure. I'd rather, if I was going to play one of those more obscure metals, I would buy something like Teck. And Teck is North America's okay. largest producer of germanium. Yeah. And so you get exposure to lead and zinc and copper, and then you've got germanium in there. So I'd rather do that because I just find not a lot of people really know much about those more obscure ones.
Yeah.
And there's not enough liquidity there or interest for me. But the one I do like that I don't think a lot of people yet have caught on to is vanadium. I think the potential okay. case for vanadium redox flow batteries is very interesting. Robert Friedland under Ivanhoe Electric has a vanadium battery production company. And so that's one I think that people should okay. watch for sure.
Okay, interesting. So really you like to stick to what you might say is easy. You know, gold and copper is easy to understand. The case is easy to understand, whereas the other commodities, you know, because rare earths, for example, I like rare earth, but I have to admit, I don't really understand them as I would understand a copper mine or a copper grade or a gold grade, for example. I'm still learning, but I don't know why I like them, to be honest with you, but I can see how their use case. But you're right, the liquidity is just not there because people like me, they don't fully understand those commodities. So you're sticking to what's easy effectively.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Could you give any golden nuggets away, something that perhaps anyone watching today could perhaps use to help spot their own mining gem?
Well, some of the things I've talked about in terms of, I really think it's important to check the insider transactions. That is sure. key. do you want to hear some of my picks? Is that
if you're happy to share them, Jenny, you'd love to. Yeah.
I thought maybe I prefer not to give too much information about them because I find, and I was guilty of this myself in the past, is if somebody gives you a little bit too much information, then you tend to do less research yourself.
Yes.
And so, as I mentioned, I really like all the ones that I've been holding, and I do think it's early days for a lot of them. So when I spoke about Peru, I think there's some really amazing buys right now in Peru. However, one thing that people need to be aware of, they have had a bit of an uptick in violence recently. There's concerns about illegal mining there, especially in gold. And so I'll give a few names in Peru, but given that it's just one jurisdiction, I'll maybe give a couple others that are outside of Peru as well. But sure. One thing I should mention too is we were talking about obscure metals. The other thing that I would tell people to exercise caution on, the times that I have been burned is when I've gone too large on a single asset company, because if it doesn't work out, then there's no backup plan. And, you know, I've learned to take smaller positions for sure. So one of the ones I'm going to mention from Peru that's something to consider there is it's a single asset company. Now, I know they're looking to acquire more, but at this point, it is in a high-risk community as well in Peru. But that's Copernico. I don't know if you've heard of Copernico Metals with Ivan Bebek, the CEO. Okay. So it's COPR.TO, and they have the Sombrero project, and it is in a high-risk community in terms of in 1983, there was a pretty horrific attack on the local community by the Shining Path terrorist group. And they really, it took a lot of time to build a relationship with the local community. And I really have a lot of admiration for the team, Ivan Bebek and the management there, because it took them 3 years to get social license for the project for that reason. And now that they've done that, you know, they worked really hard before a shovel even went into the ground. And I think that will pay huge dividends for them in the future that they took the time to do that. But Tech owns 10%. They had a strategic investment for 10%. And Newmont, I think, has 6% of the company, and there's significant inside ownership. And Ivan Bebek, he has a very impressive track record, but I find, and Rick, I know, has commented on this as well, a lot of people don't have patience. And Ivan, his track record now, the huge successes he had were several years ago. And I don't think people are really factoring in with this particular venture how long it took him to get that social license and what had to be done. And so I think people are thinking it's a negative when it's actually a positive. And so I would suggest people look at Copernico. The two others that I really like in Peru, I mentioned the one I've been holding for a very long time that they're just really marketing it now, is Camino Minerals. And what I like about Camino, first of all, a CEO has an impressive track record. His name is Jay Schmalauskas, and he's worked fairly closely with Robert Friedland. But he was co-founder of Lithium Americas. So that's, you know, pretty big notch in his belt. And then he also started, he went from just exploration to production of the second largest gold producing mine in China. That's quite an accomplishment. So I think Jay is really impressive, but Camino has four assets. And what I really like about one in particular, they just made an acquisition in Chile, and that's, they're anticipating it will be revenue producing by 2027. And so that should reduce dilution going forward. So they have the one that will be under construction likely next year. And then they have the three in Peru that are all in different areas. And so that kind of reduces your exposure to jurisdiction risk too. And then the last one in Peru is Copper X. Have you ever heard of Copper X?
No, I haven't heard of Copper X either, no.
Okay, so that one is CUEX.V. And the team is just incredibly impressive. It actually includes Robert Quartermain as an advisor. And they are backed by the Discovery Group. And Discovery Group was behind Great Bear and some other impressive ones, that it's great to have them in your corner because they have a really easy time accessing capital. And the CEO of that company is Dave Prinz, who was with Pretium. And Pretium, if you've heard that story, that one sold for, I believe, $19 a share. It was BC Gold. And so he has a really impressive track record, but he was buying quite a bit of the stock at, I think, 50 cents. And it's now, it's now down to about 7 cents. So it's really
cheap. Okay.
So for Peru, Copernico, Copper X, and Camino are my three favorites. And then, have you ever heard of Carolina Rush? That's another one of my favorites.
Yeah, they've come across my radar.
Okay, so Carolina Rush, one of the things that I like about them, they have quite a low share count. But North Carolina, to me, is fascinating. And I think that that is a jurisdiction that people really haven't caught on to yet.
Okay.
But prior to the California Gold Rush, North Carolina was actually the leading gold producer in the United States.
Right.
And then the Civil War happened, and a lot of the mines shut down, and the miners left to become soldiers. And it just really never took off again after that. But Carolina Rush, they have the Brewer Project, which is, I believe, 17 kilometers along strike from the Hale Gold Mine, which was bought by Oceana Gold a few years ago for over $800 million. And I think there's a lot of potential with Brewer, but they also had Richard Sillitoe, world-renowned geologist in his 80s. He came out and did up a report for them and kind of determined the more interesting drill targets. And so going forward with that guidance, I think there's potentially, they have some really interesting drill holes ahead. And then the last one that I'll mention is Bull Gold. And you know them. So that one is really early. They haven't started marketing at all. I don't even think there's an interview out yet. But I have been talking a little bit to the CEO via email, and I have a call coming up with him. But they have a few assets in the Slovak Republic and Bulgaria. And first time for me investing in the Tethyan Belt. But this team, they're former Dundee guys, and they have just they made incredible tier one discoveries in that region. And Dundee is actually I think they own 12% to the company, and share the insiders hold a significant amount too. So retail only holds about 42% of the float, and it's a very small share count. It's hard to find one like that. I think there's only 27 or 29 million shares outstanding. And so that one I find very interesting as well. So,
yeah, good. They were at the Swiss Mining Institute, actually, Go Gold. Yeah. And there was a lot of people watching that presentation, I noticed.
So, good. Thank you.
Maybe an early state, an early opportunity to get in, particularly if you say they've not started marketing it. I think that's a really good sign as well, as obvious. But then, you know, usually what I find is the most obvious things is what's actually happening. When a company wants to come out and talk about it, it's you know, usually a good time. What we're finding at the moment as I interview CEOs, you know, we do podcasts, they don't want to come on. Why? Because they've got nothing really they want to sort of shout about, really, because of the way things are. But that will change. It has to change. I want to finish off on something that you tweeted recently. It was a quote from Pierre Lassonde, which said that copper is the critical metal. Without it, we have no transportation, no communication, no electricity. I know you really like this slide, don't you, that you tweeted fairly recently. And this, maybe you can talk us through it. I mean, it's kind of obvious what it is, but maybe just talk us through what you really like about it, Jenny.
So, you know, looking at it, I think it's such a great representation of where copper is at in terms of a lot of the easy stuff is gone. You know, there's been a real lack of investment in exploration for the last 15, 20 years. And what is out there, it's a lot deeper, more expensive to mine, and more difficult to find. And I think that's a huge part for me of the copper bull case, that, like I said, all the easy stuff is gone. But those mines that are nearing now the end of their life, there's declining ore grades and production is declining. And so I think this is a really great representation of where we're at. Is going forward, the copper supply cupboard is really empty. And as Lassonde said, it's the essential metal. I mean, we've been using copper as humans for 10,000 years now, and that's not going away anytime soon. And you know, you can consider potential tailwinds for the demand case, like AI data centers and you know, EVs and the energy transition. But even without that, it really is a supply side issue that I think we're going to be facing. Even if demand just held steady as it is, going forward, it's clear that we don't have enough to keep up with the world's population. And there's so much growth that's occurring in the middle class in these emerging markets, Indonesia and Vietnam and India. And you just need copper for these people to have a higher standard of living. And we don't have the supply. And so I love this graphic because I really think it's a great representation of where we're at for the supply side.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. No, it's a really good graphic. Like you say, the easy stuff is all gone, really. So it only gets harder, really, which I guess means you've probably got to be even more picky with your stocks, really, and do that research even more than perhaps you used to. If I was to ask you to, Jenny, just maybe finish off with maybe just a key takeaway or something that you could perhaps give listeners here who are perhaps either just starting on their investing journey. Our audience is mostly what we would call retail, so it's not necessarily funds, it's more like ordinary people who want to put a bit of money away, invest it, and hopefully grow it. So people who are just getting started, but also perhaps people who have been around and particularly perhaps came in during that COVID boom, let's say, and perhaps are hurting quite a bit now. I know that the volume has certainly dropped off in terms of chat in the groups that we keep an eye on. People have been hurting because of, the heat came off the sector effectively. If you were to give any sort of, I wouldn't say advice, but just a key thought of either how to regroup or where to focus your efforts on key commodities, any words of wisdom from you?
A couple things. I'd be very cautious who you listen to on social media because, with the onset of the pandemic, there was actually a lot of fraudulent activity that went on. And I find a lot of people will assume if somebody has like a large following that their word can be taken as the gospel truth. And that is not always the case. So I'd advise people to be very careful about who they listen to and always do their own homework. But as we mentioned earlier, I think because it's such a small industry and investing in the right people is of paramount importance, that you do yourself the biggest favor by trying to attend at least one conference a year. And I know it's hard for people to travel to some of these. And if you can't, most of them are available virtually. And I think that's definitely worth your time. But going in person, if you can, is just a great way to really give you an edge. And for me, I attended Brian London's conference in New Orleans in November. And that's the oldest running investment conference in North America. This year will be their 51st year. And if you look at the list of speakers they've had in the past, like Alan Greenspan, there's been incredible names. And, when I went, I spoke on Rick Rule's mining panel there. But the people that you can learn from, you really don't get that opportunity just by doing your own research at home. And so I highly recommend that you can, if you can, attend these conferences. So Brian's is running again in November, and New Orleans is a great city to visit. So that's one I'd put on your list. And then the other one I really love too is Jay Martin's Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. And I think because a lot of the mining sector is based in Vancouver, it's probably one of the best to attend. I've been to PDAC in Toronto, and they're both very large cities, but the Vancouver one just has a really great feel to it. It's more intimate. And I really benefited from attending that one a few times. And so if you can make it to that one, that's for sure one I'd put on your list. And then the last one, we've talked about Rick Rule a little bit. And, I get a kick out of this because whenever I go to these conferences and he walks in the room, people almost want to ask for his autograph. It's like he's a rock star. And outside of natural resources, like not many people know who he is, but he's adored with good reason. And the other conference I'm really hoping to attend this year is his symposium in Boca Raton in July. And that one, you know, some of the biggest names in the industry are there, Robert Friedland, Ross Beaty, and you actually have the chance to get up close and talk to these people. And so if you have the chance, I really think it's worth your time to attend some of these, because networking is key. And I found I have a circle that I built via Twitter and these conferences. And it's really great to have a community that you can bounce ideas off of and never be afraid to hear the negatives, because you might really like a company. And because of that, you might ignore a red flag or two. And it's great to have people that you can have honest, respectful discussion with that will bring up some of the things that you might have missed. And so I think that's a really important factor, is to just build a trusted circle that you can discuss these ideas with.
Excellent. I think that's very, very good, Jenny. And I would agree with you that going in person, if you can. I know it's difficult. When I first went to it, one, I was terrified my car wouldn't make it. It was a pretty rubbish car, and it wasn't either. It was a lot younger. But I can tell you that, going to that first one, it really set the road effectively to really what, in fact, changed my life, not just with investing, but career-wise as well. So I do hope to see you perhaps at the Rick Rule one, because I know Rick's invited me a couple of times to that. So I'll hope to try and get there this year. But Jenny Shaggis, or Jenny Many Dots on X, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Mark. It was great to chat.
Excellent. Brilliant. There we go. Fantastic.